What we can do, in order to put reins to our impatience, is to extend somewhat our notion of the present, to include in it somewhat larger entities of sequence, and make of them a sort of loose coincidence in time. And the period we have in hand is quite suited to such a procedure, the years, that is, in which Joseph became first Petipre's body servant and then his head overseer. They even demand such treatment, because there were circumstances which, quite contrary to probability, contributed to his success, and not only so, but exercised an influence afterwards. And these played a part like an all-pervasive atmosphere even in the beginning, so that one cannot even discuss the early stages without bringing them in. Our source, after confirming the fact of Joseph's second purchase, promptly states that he was in the house of his master the Egyptian. Certainly there he was. Where else? He had been sold into that house, and there he was. The tradition seems to assert the known, and to be redundant. But let us be sure that we understand it. To say that he was in Potiphar's house means that he remained there, which is a new fact, and one to be emphasized. After he was bought, Joseph remained in Potiphar's house. That is to say, he escaped by God's will the imminent danger of being sent to field labor, where he would by day have fainted in the heat, by night have shaken with cold, and might easily, under the lash of a barbarous overseer, have ended his days obscurely and in want, uncherished, unadvanced. The sword hovered over him. We must wonder that it did not fall. It hung loose enough. Joseph was an alien sold into Egypt, a son of Asia, an Amu boy, a Shabirite or Hebrew. We must realize the contempt felt for such in this most arrogant of lands before we pass on to explain the influence which weakened and counteracted it. We have seen that Montcalm was tempted for a second or so to regard Joseph more or less as a god. But that does not mean that, certainly in the beginning, he did not think of him more rather than less as a man. For of course he did. The denizen of Kempt, whose forebears had drunk from the waves of the sacred river, at home in an unsurpassable land crowded with temples, statues, and writings compelling from old time, where once the sun god in person had been king, was too expressly aware of his status as man to have much esteem left over for non-Egyptians, such as Negroes from Kush, Libyan pigtail-wearers, and Asiatic louse-beards. The conception of uncleanness and abomination was not an invention of the seed of Abram, and by no means peculiar to the sons of Shem. Some things they held in common detestation, as, for instance, the pig. But to the Egyptians, the Hebrews were themselves an abomination. It went against them to break bread together. Indeed, some 20 years later, when Joseph, God consenting, had become to all intents and purposes an Egyptian, he had foreign barbarians served separately when such sat at his table, in order to keep himself in countenance with his own. This was the position in Egypt respecting the people of Amu and Haru, and such was the view taken of Joseph himself when he first came. So that it is really a miracle that he remained in Potiphar's house and had not to perish in the fields. Or rather, it is to be marveled at. For a miracle, a wonder-working of God in the full sense of the word, it was not. What actually came in play was the human. Matters of taste and custom. Influences which, as I said above, weakened and even abrogated the effect of the fundamental tradition. Not that the latter was not vocal. It spoke indeed in the voice of Dudu, spouse of Jeset, who demanded that Joseph be sent to field labor. For Dudu was not only a man, or a manling, of great and solid dignity, he was also spokesman and defender of the sacred and traditional in all its strictness. He was fundamentally pious, and withal, as a party man, he held with a school of thought which, committed by every consideration of state, ethics, and religion to an organic and militant unity, had to dispute its position against less limited and reactionary views. This school, so far as Petipre's establishment was concerned, had its seat in the House of Women, more precisely, in the apartments of the mistress, Mut-em-Enet. For a familiar guest in those apartments was a certain man whose rigid personality made him the center and nucleus of the traditional view. This man was Bekneckans, the first prophet of Amun. We shall speak of him later, for it was only after some time that Joseph first heard of the man. Indeed, he only gradually gained insight into the situation hinted at above. However, he would have needed to be much less acute than he was, much less quick in sizing up advantage and disadvantage, not to have gained some inkling of essentials even in his first conversations with the servants of the house. His method was to behave as though he already knew, as well as anybody, the inner mysteries and secrets of the country. His Egyptian sounded quaint and amusing in the ear of the natives, and he made no haste to regularize it. But his choice of words was both lively and judicious as he talked about the rubber-eaters, glibly adopting the popular name for the Nubian Moors whom he had seen crossing the river to audience on his arrival, or repeated the carping words of the gentleman at the levee. They would not, he said, succeed in undermining the prince-prefect of Kush, for the latter had cut away the ground under their feet by the surprisingly lordly tribute with which he had rejoiced the heart of Pharaoh. All this made them laugh much more than if he had told them something new, and the way they made merry over his strange speech, even admiring it and listening to the Canaanitish words with which he helped himself out, shed even now some light on the problem of advantage and disadvantage. For they tried, as best they could, to speak as he did, mixing into their sentences scraps of Akkadian or Babylonian, as well as words from Joseph's own linguistic sphere. He divined, long before he could know it for a fact, that they were imitating the elegant attitude of their masters, and that these in turn did not ape the foreigner of their own motion, but because they wished to copy the manners of a still higher sphere, namely the court. Joseph grasped the situation, as I have said, long before he could actually know it. He smiled to himself as he did so. These little people, so absurdly vain because they were brought up on Nile water and born in the land of men, the only true birthplace of the gods, would have laughed to scorn the slightest doubt cast upon the superiority of their civilization over that of any of the surrounding countries. They were full to overflowing with the martial glory of their kings. Their Ahmoses and Thutmoses and Amenhoteps, who had conquered the earth as far as the contrary flowing Euphrates and advanced their boundary stones to the northern Retenu and the deserts and bowmen of the farthest south. And then, secure as they were weak and childish enough to be openly envious of his Canaanitish speech, and that it was his mother tongue, and against all reason and sense to regard it as meritorious that he could speak it. Why? Because Canaanitish was good form. And why good form? Because it was foreign and strange. But the foreign and strange was of no value and worthless. Yes, of course. But in spite of that, it was good form. And this inconsequential esteem rested, in their own opinion, not on weakness or childishness, but on liberality of thought. Joseph felt this. He was the first person in the world to feel it, since the phenomenon now appeared for the first time in the world. It was the freedom of thought possessed by people who had not themselves conquered those wretched foreign lands, but had it done for them by their forebears, and now took leave to make liberal thought the mode. The example was given by the great. The house of Petipray, the fan-bearer, made that clear to Joseph. For the more he saw, the plainer it became that most of its treasures came from the port. In other words, were importations. In fact, they came in larger part from Joseph's own sphere, in a narrower or more extended sense, from Syria and Canaan. That was flattering. At the same time, he found it a little undignified. For on the leisurely journey from the delta to the house of Amun, he had had ample occasion to admire the native skill and craftsmanship of Pharaoh's country. Potiphar's horses were Syrian stock. It was indeed better to get them from Syria or Babylonia, for the Egyptian strain was poorish. But his chariots as well, and that very one with its wheels inlaid with stones like fireworks, were imported too. Then his cattle came from the land of the Amorites, which could be nothing else than a freak of fashion, considering the beauty of the domestic breed with its lyre-shaped horns, the mild-eyed Hathor cows and the strong bulls from whose number Merwer and Hoppy were chosen, Pharaoh's friend carried an inlaid walking stick from Syria, and from Syria came the beer and the wine he drank. The jugs that held them came from the port as well, likewise the weapons and musical instruments which adorned his rooms. Ornamental vases almost the height of a man stood in painted alcoves in the northern and western hippostyle halls and on both sides of the dais in the dining room. The gold they were made of came doubtless from Nubian mines, but the vases were shaped in Damascus and Sidon. A reception and banqueting hall, entered by stately doors from the court itself, lay in front of the family dining room. In it, Joseph was shown other vases, somewhat eccentric in shape and decoration, from Edom, the Goat Mountains. They brought to mind Esau, his foreign uncle. He, too, was obviously the fashion here. So were the gods themselves of Amor and Canaan, Baal and Astarte. They were considered very elegant. Joseph could tell by the way Potiphar's people took it for granted that they were his, asked about them, and paid them compliments. It seemed a feeble sort of broad-mindedness, because after all, in the imagination of the people, the relations between the powers of the various countries were incorporated in the gods, and were only the expression of their personal life. Indeed, what was the thing itself, and what their picture? What the reality, and what the paraphrase? Was it just a manner of speaking to say that Amun had conquered the gods of Asia and made them tributary, when the actual fact was that Pharaoh had subdued the kings of Canaan? Or was the latter only an unreal and sublunary expression for the former? Joseph knew that you could not distinguish. The thing and the image, the actual and the non-actual, formed an inextricably interwoven whole. But that was just why the folk of Mizraim were abandoning Amun, not only when they flattered Baal and Ashtaroth, but also when they interlarded the tongue of their own gods with fragments of the speech of the children of Shem, and said Sepher for scribe, and Nechel for river, because the Canaanitish words were Sopher and Nahal. It was indeed a free-thinking spirit which underlay these fashions, whims, and habits, and free-thinking against Egyptian Amun. The issue of it was a much less thoroughgoing distaste for the Semitic and Asiatic. In his estimating advantage and disadvantage, Joseph booked this fact on the credit side. Thus he took note of fluctuations and variable currents of thought and opinion, growing, as I said, more able to judge them with each day that he lived and observed the life of the land. His master, Potiphar, was a courtier, one of the friends of Pharaoh. It was not hard to guess that this loose tolerance of foreign ways, this rebellion against Amun displayed in Potiphar's life and habits, had its source over there in the west, beyond the Nechel, in the great house. Had it, Joseph wondered, to do with Amun's warrior hosts, the lance-bristling temple troops which had shoved him to the wall in the Street of the Sun? With Pharaoh's displeasure, when Amun, too powerful already as the established god of the state, competed with him on the military side as well? What strange, far-reaching considerations! Pharaoh's irritation at the presumption of Amun or his temple became perhaps the final reason why Joseph had not to go and labor in the fields, but might remain in his master's house, and came on the fields much later, in the capacity not of laborer, but of overseer and administrator. The situation, which made the boy profit from considerations of so lofty and far-reaching a kind, pleased the young slave Osarsif, and made a bond, aside from that to his present master, with the highest. But something else rejoiced him even more, a more pervasive atmosphere in this world to which he had been transplanted. He detected it as he sniffed for advantage or disadvantage with that pretty, if rather thick-nostrilled, nose of his. And it was an air in which he was as much at home as a fish in water. For the prevailing atmosphere, to put it in an old phrase, was fin de siècle. It was that of a society composed of descendants and heirs, already remote from the patterns of the founding fathers whose victories had put their successors in the frame of mind to regard the conquered as elegant. It appealed to Joseph, for he himself was late, too, in time and in his soul, a very good specimen of a descendant, volatile, witty, difficult, and interesting. So he felt like a fish in water, and filled with lively hope that by God's help he would do honor to him and to himself, and go very far in Pharaoh's land.